KBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. A New York jury sides with columnist E. Jean Carroll, finding former President Trump defamed her by calling her allegations of sex assault a hoax and a lie.
Historically, that's true with stars.
He bragged in his deposition that stars could get away with sexually assaulting women. But a jury in New York took less than 3 hours to find that former President Donald Trump sexually abused writer E. Jean Carroll, ordering him to pay her $5 million in damages.
ABC's Aaron Katursky. No deal yet, but President Biden and congressional leaders will hold more talks about raising the debt ceiling to avoid default by June 1st.
America is not a deadbeat nation. We pay our bills, and avoiding default is a basic duty of the United States Congress.
Congressional Republicans want budget cuts for raising the debt limit, which President Biden refuses. Sources say Republican Congressman George Santos has been charged by federal prosecutors in New York, which are under seal. He could appear in court this week. This is ABC News. Chinese security agents raiding several offices of business consulting firm CapVision as part of an ongoing crackdown on foreign businesses that provide sensitive economic data. Coming soon to a Wendy's near you, artificial intelligence.
Wendy's is partnering up with Google to bring an AI chatbot to the drive-thru. The Wall Street Journal reports they've customized Google's large language model to understand terms Wendy's customers use often, like using JBC in place of Junior Bacon Cheeseburger. The AI has also been trained to upsell, suggesting larger sizes or daily specials. Once a customer places their order with the chatbot, it appears on a screen for the line cooks. Then the driver just pulls ahead to the pickup window as normal. The chatbot rolls out next month at a Wendy's location in Columbus, Ohio. Mike Dubusky, ABC News.
It was a record ski season. National Ski Areas Association reporting 64.7 million ski visits. That's up nearly 7% from last year. Andy Field, ABC News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios. Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. The man suspected of killing a Western Wisconsin deputy was out on parole Saturday afternoon. That's according to Minnesota prison officials. Jeremiah Johnson was convicted of kidnapping and rape in 2016. Johnson has a long history of committing violent crimes. Investigators say he killed Katie Lysing during a drunk driving stop Saturday. Looks like he shot himself about an hour later. The Brewers are changing their alcohol sales policy again. It's been a month since the team decided to extend the deadline to buy alcohol into the eighth inning, but now the deadline is moving back to the seventh. The Brewers say they didn't have any issues, it's just that extending the deadline didn't increase sales by that much. In sports, the Brewers beat the Dodgers last night 9-3. Eric Lauer starts for Milwaukee tonight. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
He's the grave digger, Gilbert Brown.
Where can you go where it's always a standard room only? You ain't gonna find that in Chicago.
It's never personal, only politics.
You ain't gonna find that in Minnesota, standing room only, because you can go to the gumball machine, stick a quarter in there, I'll come pick it.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
That's the way it is, man. We love football fans. Fans love us.
Weekdays 4 to 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
VA has a new life insurance program for veterans with service-connected disabilities called Veterans Affairs Life Insurance, or VA Life. VA Life benefits include up to $40,000 in coverage, no medical questions to enroll, and no time limit to apply if you are age 80 or under. Veterans can apply, receive an instant decision, and manage their policy online. Learn more about VA Life or apply online by visiting va.gov/life-insurance. Protect those who matter most with VA Life Insurance.
You were supposed to get a colon cancer screening, but stuff came up.
We did have to pick up the twins from practice.
But on the way, we hit a giant pothole.
If you are 45 and older, don't let stuff get in the way of your screening. Visit the Colorectal Cancer Alliance at ccalliance.org.
But then...
VA has a new life insurance program for veterans with service-connected disabilities called Veterans Affairs Life Insurance, or VA Life. VA Life benefits include up to $40,000 in coverage, no medical questions to enroll, and no time limit to apply if you are age 80 or under. Veterans can apply, receive an instant decision, and manage their policy online. Learn more about VA Life or apply online by visiting va.gov/life-insurance. Protect those who matter most with VA Life Insurance.
Continue the conversation online. Find and follow Civic Media on Facebook and on Twitter. Your hometown radio, refreshed. Keeping you informed, entertained, and connected on the Civic Media Network. CivicMedia.us.
Do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I've gotten a lot of email around the E. Jean Carroll verdict. A lot of people, you know, thinking, hey, this is a big victory. Yay, finally, he's being held accountable. I'm like, I don't know. I don't know if he's being held accountable for anything. It doesn't look good. But even out of this, it's not what he should be getting out of it, thanks to George Santos and them you know, arresting him. So I don't know what this is going to mean, and I don't really care. This was never important to me as a get Trump moment. I think Georgia, that's what I want to focus on. But here to share some thoughts on whether this matters, whether I'm wrong or not, I've asked our good friend Bill Scheer to come share some thoughts with us. Bill is the political editor, the politics editor over at the Washington Monthly. Bill, thanks for taking time for us.
Always a pleasure to talk to you.
So is this a big deal? Does this change anything? Does this matter? Is it a BFD?
The Trump verdict?
Yes.
Well, this is yet another test of the Republican Party's integrity, and also I think their political intelligence. They should want to excise Trump from their party. Trump is dead weight. He has been a net negative for the GOP the last three election cycles, 2018, 2020, 2022. His one victory was a fluke, just barely snuck in without winning the popular vote. There's no reason to think he is the savior. I'm not saying it's impossible for him to win again. Obviously, you can see the confluence of events if the economy turns sour, or, you know, Joe Biden, you know, literally, you know, collapse on a stage, for example. But you wouldn't want to put all your eggs in the Trump basket if you had the choice. Yet every time there's been an opportunity to say, no mas, the leading Republicans don't take him out. When the indictment happened from the Madden DA, they attacked the Madden DA. Now you have a jury verdict. I mean, there should be 100 Republican voices demanding he withdraw from the race.
Yeah, there's only one now, right?
Ace Hutchinson is the only one who said something along those lines?
Maybe two. Nancy Mace has come out and said something.
Oh, Nancy Mace. Well, there's definitely the kingfish of the Republican Party, Nancy Mace. I mean, Ron DeSantis. I mean, step up, buddy. You're getting lapped.
Well, Trump is crushing him. The latest poll has him up by 41.
Yes. What are you waiting for? Take your shot. But I mean, I grant that it's hard for one person to do it. This is a collective action problem. But I guarantee you there are several hundred elected Republicans that want to see Trump out of there, but just don't have the gumption to do it. But if they worked in concert, maybe they'd get somewhere. And the fact that they can't do it here, I heard folks say, well, because I've been negative about the way DeSantis has handled things. And some of his defenders said, oh, don't worry. Wait till he gets it. Wait till he gets it. He'll start taking his swings. He's no chump. Well, you can't expect him to do it for the Manhattan DA because that was such a phony indictment anyway. You know, wait until something real happens. Okay, I'm waiting. Here I am waiting. What's it going to take? These are the same people that wanted Bill Clinton to resign because he was one having a mirror affair with Monica Lewinsky or being accused of sexual harassment from Paula Jones. Where are they now?
Yeah.
So,
well, those were Democrats. That's the difference. No, this is the weird place we're in because it seems like every one of these scandals, you know, seems to make him stronger with the base, and I think that's what the elites are afraid of. They're afraid that they're going to lose their job, so they don't want to get on the bad side of Trump's base, which I think is shrinking, to be honest with you, because even the my neighbors who are rah rah Trump are flying DeSantis flags.
Well, look, I mean, to be a little charitable to our Republican friends, they're in a tough position because there clearly is a very devout Trump base that if they stayed home, they would not win elections. So I understand the surface logic. Well, we got to find a way to maintain our Trump base, but get beyond that to get to 50% or get to an electoral college majority. And so we have to be more careful. We have to finesse this. We have to do a little wink, wink here, wink, wink there, so we can appeal to the middle without losing, you know, the hardcore. But everything that we have seen about the way Trump operates, how Trump overshadows whatever other positives Republicans might have, this is a cancer on the party. And it may mean losing in the short run to excise the tumor. But there's no reason to believe that letting the tumor grow is a long-term strategy. So when these opportunities present themselves, they need to seize the moment, and every time they shirk from it because they're afraid of the short run. They refuse to think long run because they're so afraid of the short run.
Which is weird because the Republicans have always historically been the long game players. So that's why this is interesting to me. Now, I want to get your thoughts on the George Santos thing, which has, you know, taken some of the air out of the Trump bubble of this news cycle. Is this a big deal?
I don't think the average voter pays attention to much to Santos. He's sort of a sideshow story. It's not as evident what the grander import is to the average person. I mean, Trump is literally the Republican frontrunner. Right. Trump is
then the big question of this, and then we'll move on because I don't want to spend too much time on Santos. Will he show up in drag?
I don't expect that, of course, but it is relevant whether Republicans cut him loose or not. I mean, if he resigns, that's a lost vote in the House, and the House majority is that narrow. So, you have seen Republicans kick certain, you know, they kick Steve King to the curb, for example, but they were fairly confident that he would be replaced by Republicans. So there wasn't as much of a risk. If Santos actually was forced out or pressured out, and there's a special election, they would probably lose that special election. So just to do the basic functioning of government requires every last, vote McCarthy and get his hands on. So it really puts him in a tough position in that respect.
Right.
But that's why I think you'll probably see McCarthy not want to force Santos out on the logic that the average voter probably isn't paying that close attention to it.
Right.
And they need the vote.
Now, because, you know, they've lost another vote today with Texas Republican Brian Slayton. He's out the door now because of the ethics.
This is on. I'm not aware of this story.
Well then, the good God fearing Christian Republican representative from Texas, Brian Slayton, evidently he was getting his 19-year-old staff member drunk and having his way with him. And well, that's bad.
So did he? So he resigned?
No, they went through the ethics process, and the they voted today to oust him.
Oh, I did not know this. I mean, but you need a 2/3 vote to actually expel him, right?
Well, they went, this is out of the ethics committee. So we'll see where that goes from here. But yeah. I gotta assume he's done. No.
Well, I mean, I assume if there's an ethics vote, that was a unanimous bipartisan vote, that's a 50-50 split in the ethics committee. It would seem logical that Republicans will follow suit and actually expel him. But I would gather, if he's a Republican congressperson from Texas, I'm guessing he's not in a swing district. I'm guessing that'll be replaced with another Republican in fairly short order. So
yeah, I screwed that up. My bad. He was a House member in Texas. My bad.
Oh, this is a state house.
Yeah, I screwed that up.
Okay.
I was hoping. yeah, as I'm saying it, I'm going, that was dumb. Why did I jump in the middle of that? But here again, you've got these moments where there's a lot of scandal going on that side of the aisle that needs to be dealt with. Listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Bill Scheer. Bill is the political editor over at the Washington Monthly, WashingtonMonthly.com, the website. Want to get your thoughts on the big meeting today with the president and Speaker McCarthy. Are we surprised that nothing came out of it?
I disagree that nothing came out of it. I think the fact that they said staff is going to meet, the party leaders are going to meet on Friday, they scheduled a day. Biden gave a press conference and said that clawing back unspent COVID funds is on the table, which is effectively making a concession in public. I think there's genuine movement here. If they came out and just, talked trash about each other and didn't schedule anything, then I think you'd see, some market panic. They're sending signals here that the game is afoot. Biden said that, and almost every Democrat has said, we're not going to negotiate to a gun to our head. We're not going to negotiate if they're threatening a default. But McCarthy did not promise to pass a clean debt limit hike, and yet negotiations are moving forward. So I think and there's obviously a long way to go. I'm not saying that. It's not going to be a bumpy road from this point forward. But my general attitude is I don't think either Biden or McCarthy wants to default.
No, I don't think so.
And I don't think either one of them have said anything to preclude a deal. There's not a lot of red lines being drawn here. There's not a lot of non-negotiable demands being made. So there's a lot of room for a deal. I think there is desire for a deal, and usually when you have those two things, you get to a deal.
My problem is I look at McCarthy, he's holding on to power, and I would argue in a very slim fashion. And you've got the Freedom Caucus folks who, in my view, I think they do want to shoot the hostage. And I don't know that McCarthy has a lot of wiggle room. I'm curious your thoughts.
Well, McCarthy, he has a very tenuous majority. He has, a few Freedom Caucus types who have suggested they're willing to actually shoot the hostage and default on the debt. But apologies for the dog. But you also have 18 Republicans in Biden 1 districts. And he can only lose 5 votes to lose a majority. So he is, I would assume McCarthy is much like Pelosi was before, attentive to the needs of those that make the majority. The Biden district members make the majority, not the Freedom Caucus people. So he is much more constrained in the kinds of threats he can make because he would then risk losing those relative moderates. When people talk about what happened in 2011 and the debt limit talks there, that was on the heels of the Tea Party victory in 2010, netting 63 seats. There are 242 Republicans in the majority at that point. So Boehner, who wasn't, say, a Tea Party guy himself, he was there was a sense of a mandate for doing something big on the budget that Boehner had to be sensitive of. This midterm was practically a Democratic victory. The Republicans barely took the majority. And so McCarthy, John Boehner in 2011 said, we're not going to raise the debt limit unless the cuts are bigger than the amount we're raising the debt limit. There was a specific ask. McCarthy's done nothing like that because he doesn't have the ability to be that provocative without alienating those in the middle. So he's been being much more of a reasonable figure. I just want to talk. We passed the bill, but that's just a starting point. We just want to have Biden have the negotiations. The thing that McCarthy has to worry about is if he did a deal with Biden, it only takes one member to do a so-called motion to vacate and put the speakership itself on the floor, sort of fire McCarthy.
Right.
And if there was a party line vote and five Republicans broke ranks, he's no longer speaker. That is the so-called sword hanging over McCarthy's head. I have not seen the Freedom Caucus people wave that sword. McCarthy promised in January, when he got the gavel, I'm going to push for a 10-year balanced budget plan. That's the promise I give to you in order for you to vote for me for Speaker. Where is it?
Exactly.
It's nowhere. He put a bill on the floor that is nowhere near a 10-year balanced budget, and those Freedom Caucus guys, they shut up. So I am not convinced that these Freedom Caucus people have the moxie to actually shoot the hostage being McCarthy. And so if McCarthy thinks, you know what, I have already proven that I can move away from those extreme demands, put a bill on the floor, most of those guys will vote for it. No one's talking about taking off my head. If I do a deal with Biden to avert a default and I get 180 Republicans plus Democrats to pass it, maybe I can get away with that and not lose my speakership. Because if they fire him, who do they replace him with? Do they even want the job themselves? That job is not fun. I'm not want to make hard predictions here. Maybe they will do a motion to vacate. But we haven't seen them making those threats, even though McCarthy has moved away from the extreme demands.
So you feel confident something's going to get done and we're not going to see any of the extremes on either side. Biden invoking the 14th Amendment and going down that road or the default.
Well, yeah, I think McCarthy doesn't, McCarthy is more like Boehner and McConnell. He doesn't see the political upside in being seen as the agitator for default. And so he's not eager to let things go that far. If there was a default and Biden took the blame, then fine. But he doesn't want to be seen as itching for it. And so he's not making unreasonable demands. 2013, Ted Cruz said, defund Obamacare. That was ridiculous. Any reasonable person would know that Obama's not going to defund Obamacare. And so you start playing hostage with something that's manifestly unreasonable, that blows back on you. McCarthy is just saying, let's talk. Let's cut spending somewhere, some number. He isn't being specific about the number. That makes it hard to paint him as the instigator, which is where I think McCarthy wants to be. Now, Biden, here's another difference between today and 2011. 2011, we're still in the early stages of recovery from the Great Recession.
Right.
Unemployment is still very high. It came down from 10% to 9%, still very high. Growth was not gangbusters. So there was a sense amongst Obama and other economists that it's too soon to go back to a deficit reduction. We still need to prime the pump here. And here comes John Boehner talking about big cuts. It's not the right time for it. So he was very reluctant to go down that path, but was forced to do some cuts because Boehner played hardball. Right now, unemployment is at historic lows. And your GDP has, we've had positive growth the last three quarters. Unemployment is low. Wages are up. What's the problem in the economy? It's inflation. And inflation is being met with the Fed raising interest rates. That's trying to tamp down demand. You don't want to do cuts. Obama even said in his memoir, wrong time for cuts because demand is weak. Right now, demand is not weak. The Fed is trying to contain demand. So Biden wants the soft landing. Biden wants to get inflation down without tipping into recession. So big cuts might risk recession. They're little cuts. Maybe that's complementary to what the Fed is doing. And you can tamp down demand just enough so you don't tip into recession, but you reduce inflation and Biden can say, hey, we got to have that jam. To layer on top of all this stuff, you have a deadline on September 30th to keep the government open, and they're going to be talking about the budget anyway.
Yeah.
So that's why I think they could come to this deal, because at some point in the very near future, there's going to be some kind of cuts to keep the government open. Why not do it in June instead of September?
There you go. Well, we'll see. Bill, I appreciate the time, the expertise, the input. Good stuff. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Take care.
Our good friend Bill Scheer. Make sure you check out the work that he does over at the Washington Monthly. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Well, going to be interesting to see where all this plays out. And look, nobody wants it to fall. At least I want to believe nobody wants to see a default and what the horrible that comes out of that. Let's quick go to the phones. Got Gary on line one from Florida. Gary, what's on your mind?
Hey, how are you doing? I was wondering what your opinions were on the new Florida open carry law.
I'm not a huge fan of people walking around with guns all over the place. Having grown up in a housing project where I've seen people shot, more guns to me just means more chaos.
I've purchased like several weapons since then, because I mean, I don't need a permit at this point, you know what I mean?
Right.
July 1st, man, it's kind of like, and that's 4th of July. We're really going to tune it up. 4th of July is going to be crazy.
I guarantee you are right on that front. I think it will be crazy. I think we will see lots of interesting stories to talk about. But I appreciate the thoughts, Gary. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You have a good night. No, but here's the thing. In the states that have the most guns, this isn't me making this up, you have the higher death rates. And my point is more guns does not mean more safety. More guns doesn't, like John Stewart said, you know, when do we reach peak safety? How many more guns do we need to get to that safety? For instance, Mississippi has the highest death rate per 100,000 people. They have a really high and a very easy gun laws. Louisiana, New Mexico, Alabama, Wyoming, Alaska, Montana, Arkansas, Missouri, Tennessee, South Carolina, Oklahoma, Kentucky, Georgia, all over 20 per 100,000 deaths. Now, these are the easy gun states. These are the, hey, carry them wherever you want, code them. The state with probably the highest number of restrictions, Massachusetts, has just 3.4 gun deaths per 100,000. And you look at these numbers, places where everyone isn't packing heat, you don't have this. Perfect example, talking about the Louisiana situation. You had the guy who he had to get those kids out of his yard, where yelling wasn't enough. You know, get off my lawn wasn't enough. He shot him. So, I mean, this is where my struggle with this is. And I'm not anti-gun. I believe that people have the right to go hunting and to protect their home. My problem is, man, when it's there, I mean, did you see the thing in Florida where the two guys are driving down the road firing shots at each other? And the two guys didn't hit each other. No, didn't hit each other. They hit each other's kids. This is my problem with everyone having guns. Because I know I have bad luck. I know when two people are going to get mad at each other and they're going to start shooting at each other, they're both going to hit me. So this is kind of a self-preservation thing. But I appreciate the call. Love to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1972. That was the day that employees at the Farrah Manufacturing Company went out on strike. The company was one of the top producers of men's and boys' pants in the country, and the second largest employer in El Paso, Texas. The majority of workers were Chicano. More than 80% were women. These workers worked long hours for low wages and were required to meet a high quota demand. In the late 1960s, some of the male employees began to discuss their working conditions and what they could do to change things. One employee remembered the early days of organizing, sometimes happened after softball games between the teams of workers from the different departments in the plant. We'd sit around after the game and talk about these things and the union. Men working in the cutting room voted to affiliate with the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America. Workers from the San Antonio plant came to El Paso to support the union effort. These workers were fired. In response, 500 El Paso workers walked off the job. They demanded the right to have a union. Soon, more than 3,000 Farrah employees went out on strike. The strike cause won the support of the Roman Catholic bishop in El Paso, who supported a boycott against Farrah pants. The AFL-CIO called for a boycott. The campaign against Farrah soon spread across the country. Even though the company brought in scab replacement labor, the effort to get a union continued. The fight wore on until March of 1974, when the National Labor Relations Board found in favor of the employees who had been fired. Unionization had come to Farrah. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Tiptoeing around the democratic process, Indiana's Republican legislature has become the latest of that ilk to slap its local school librarians with an idiotic book ban. Snuck into law behind closed doors, the partisan Hoosier law requires librarians to pull books that the learned lawmakers consider, quote, harmful to minors. Just to juice up the ignorance and arrogance of their ban, the law criminalizes failure to comply by punishing librarians with up to 2.5 years in prison and a $10,000 fine. What constitutes harmful to minors? Indiana's priggish politicians declared nudity, sexual references, and offensive content to community standards to be violations. Obviously, then, books commanding that rape victims marry their rapists, as well as celebrating daughters who seduce their father to bear his children, plus endorsement of bestiality, copulation in church, women boiling their children for food, and so god-awful much more, have to be ripped from the shelves and burned. Only, all of this is enshrined in the Bible, which is urged on Indiana's youngsters in Sunday schools, conveniently placed in the bedstands of every chain hotel and cited by pious lawmakers as their moral compass. The so-called good book is replete with the gross and explicit sexual material that Republican book censors call harmful. Indeed, a feisty civil libertarian organization named Freedom From Religion Foundation gives away book labels you can stick in Bibles, warning that, quote, literal belief in this book may endanger your health and life. This is Jim Hightower saying, the books that right-wing autocrats want to ban are not pornographic. They just explore ideas that those politicians don't like, ideas that young people are already grappling with. And by the way, why not require these pious lawmakers to disclose what licentious material they've been reading before they dictate what we read?
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the NFIB, the National Federation of Independent Businesses, they said today that their Small Business Optimism Index has dropped 1.1%. It is at 89%, they said last month, the lowest level since January of 2013. Now, look, I don't put any stock in what the NFIB says. In my view, one of a very anti-worker group. But look, you know, this idea that there's small business angst out there, I don't disagree with. And you look at what's going on in D.C. with the debt ceiling debacle. This is not good for small businesses. It's not good for working people. And here to share some thoughts on just what we should be doing. In fact, the group that he's a part of, Small Business for America's Future, they've put out a letter of 100 small business owners saying, hey, Congress, President, do your job. That's why I've asked Shondell Newsom to come talk with us. Shondell is a Small Business for America's Future co-chair. He's also the founder of Some New Marketing. If you want to check out their website, smallbusinessforamericasfuture.org. We'll get links out on social media. Shondell, thanks for taking time for us.
It's my pleasure, Rick. I'm happy to be here.
So you guys put out this letter, 100 folks just like you, small business owners, saying, hey, this could hurt us. This could be bad for small businesses. What do you want them to do? What's the ask? What's the demand?
Well, at the end of the day, they need all to come together and do their job. You know, they have to make sure that they go ahead and close the gap and pass the debt ceiling and increase the debt ceiling so that we can get on with our lives. I mean, we just got out of what I consider my toughest 2.5-3 years in business with the global pandemic. I went through the Great Recession as well. You know, we are resilient, but we don't like to be played with a lot. You know, small business owners are mainstream. We're not sitting trying to make extra money. We're taking care of our lives. We're working hard every day to stay in the game, and we're taking care of our employees.
Yeah, I mean, this to me has always been a stupid thing. This debt ceiling to me has always seemed stupid. We've raised it 78 times since 1960, 3 times under Trump. I've got friends who were in Congress in the past said, you know, we used to go, it was a yawn vote. You went, you raised the debt ceiling because you already spent the money. So as a small business owner, let me ask you, if you had the chance to go, yeah, we spent all this money on capital improvements. We spent all this money on materials. We just decide, we're not going to pay it. Would you?
Right. No, not at all. You know, a small business owner, as a matter of fact, we're even better than that. We're like making sure that everything is in place so we can keep the ball rolling, right? We have to make payroll. We have to pay our rent. We have to take care of the internet, whatever we have to do. So we're ahead of the game. We're not playing this little game. Like, just imagine if I walked in tomorrow and I told my employees, hey, you know what? I'm going to decide not to pay my bills and you all can just figure it out. That's kind of what they're doing to us right now.
No, and look, that's what they're doing to the federal government's employees. They're on a limb now, going, hey, am I going to have more paydays coming like we had in the past? This is ridiculous. It should be done away with, which is why your organization is calling for lawmakers to pass a clean debt ceiling bill. What does that mean?
Well, basically, at the end of the day, is just make good on what you've already spent. All it is you know, we've already spent the money, like you alluded to, is Social Security, is things that have already been laid out. You know, and again, as a small business owner, if I've already paid the bill, and it kind of reminds me a little bit of, like, you know, a lot of times we get contracts and we pay the bills, and then we get our invoice paid, and we got to pay those back, right? That's what it seems to me. I mean, I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer all the time, but I think it's pretty simple. Like, you've already spent this money. Now your invoice is getting paid. Go ahead and pay the debt and move on.
Yeah, for the people who tell us the economy is like the kitchen table, they're certainly not treating it that way. And for people who are trying to fear us into this belief that the Chinese are going to take over the global currency, being this irresponsible doesn't seem to be the smartest thing to do, does it?
No, it doesn't. You know, Rick, I spent 10 years in the Air Force. And a lot of these things that I hear sometimes, whether it's on the internet or throughout social media or people just talking about it, I spent time working on drone and stealth technology, and there are a lot of things that we already know. Like we are without a doubt the premier military forces in the world. So a lot of things when people say somebody's going to take over, they're going to do this and do that, it's hogwash. We are so far ahead of everybody else; it's not even funny.
But, you know, there's this push right now. And if you listen to right wing circles, the BRIC countries are coming together. You know, you've got Brazil, Russia, India, China. There's talk of them unseating us as the world's currency. And maybe that's not going to happen. But the fact that we're being this irresponsible, doesn't that make an argument for the rest of the world to go, I don't know what's wrong with them over there in the U.S., but maybe they shouldn't have this privilege, this power. Maybe we should do something about that. Doesn't that seem logical?
It does. I mean, when you're looking from the outside in, if you're looking dysfunctional and you're looking like you're divided as a country or as leadership, anybody would come in. If you were playing a sports team and you looked on the other side and looked like the coaches are all confused and look like they don't know what they're doing, you're going to try to take advantage of that.
Yep.
So I don't blame them for trying to take advantage of when it looks like dysfunction and divisiveness. But I can tell you, I'm headed to D.C. next week to talk about this debt ceiling piece to the senators, to a Senate committee. And so I think really I'm going to plead to them that they get their stuff together and stop making us look bad on the world stage.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But, you know, as a small business owner, what would a default mean to you? Your business is local. There's a lot of thought that, you know, this is just them in D.C. playing the games that they're playing. How would this filter down to harm, you know, businesses like yours or the other 100 people who signed on to this letter?
You know, one of the things that happens when they default or they do these type of things is they have cuts, and they make cuts in places where they don't think it impacts small businesses. So I'll give you a good example is like the SBA Boots the Business program. Last week, I went and spoke to almost 50 small businesses who are going to be formed by military members who are transitioning and becoming veterans. So imagine if you eliminate those type of opportunities for our transitioning veterans who want to become small business owners and entrepreneurs. If you put cuts into that, then that's going to impact a program like that. And again, you know, when you look at the small businesses, and everybody says we're the backbone to the economy, but they say that, you know, at a tongue in cheek, right? Last week we celebrated National Small Business Week, but, you know, really we are. We employ over half of the employees in this country. And then, like, when you look in Nevada, everybody talks about the casinos and talk about the mining, but really 99.2% of the businesses in Nevada are small businesses. So we make a difference in the economy. And so when you start playing with our money, with our passion and everything like that, it just starts to put us backwards as a country.
And I think the conversation has to be made, Shondell, that there isn't a dividing line between what government does and what Main Street does. That there's a symbiotic relationship, if you will, that there's a working together that has to happen for everyone to succeed. And for far too long, one of the political parties has pushed this idea that government can't or shouldn't be able to do anything, and they're working to destroy that. That does hurt Main Street. That does hurt folks like you, doesn't it?
Sure. Yes, it does. And in fact, think about the fact that during this pandemic, this global pandemic, where would we be without the government interceding and coming in with PPP loans or coming in with disaster loans? And then this infrastructure bill, which actually helped us, especially minority businesses, by making the MBDA, the Minority Business Development Agency, a permanent office and providing us with access to capital. There's a lot that we need. Now, what's funny is when I hear about some of the larger firms and they get tax breaks and different things like that, then all of a sudden the government is great. So I think that one thing that we have to think about is how do you make it equitable where the small businesses get all of the things that's afforded to us similar to what Wall Street firms or larger firms get when they utilize the government.
No, I'm right there with you. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Sean Del Newsome. He's the co-chair of Small Business for America's Future, smallbusinessforamericasfuture.org, the website. We'll get links out on social media. He's also the co-founder of Some New Marketing. I want to get your thoughts on this. You said you were in the Air Force for 10 years, a veteran. One of the proposals that Republicans have is what appears to be a 22% cut across the board. I've had friends over at the AFGE tell me that that applies to the Veterans Administration, which is already underfunded, which is already understaffed, overworked, all of these things. What would a cut that big mean to folks like you? What would it mean to the VA as a whole?
It's devastating. You know, I'm a veteran, my sister-in-law, my brother, my son-in-law, my daughter, my son. So, you know, basically, when you look at cuts to the VA, and I'm a disabled veteran, so that would mean that if I had some medical services, it might extend out longer than it should be. That would mean that most of our appointments would be either cut out. You know, I just went and got another pair of glasses. And so that means that maybe I might not be able to get my glasses for another 6 months. But there are some people even more crucial who are going and utilizing the VA hospital and utilizing the services on a regular basis. When you look at our pharmacy and look at how we may not be able to get access to some of the medicine. So you fought for this country. You did everything. You sacrificed your life. In many, many cases, we sacrificed our life. And that's how we'll be treated, is just as if we're another checkbox with a debt ceiling.
One of the I came across the this blog the other day that said if Republicans get their way, it means that there would be 81,000 jobs lost at the VA, 30 million fewer outpatient visits, 6,000 cuts to staff, and 134,000 increase in backlogged disability claims. You know, I got to tell you, we spent years, calling folks like you heroes, putting you up on a platform, taking photos with you. This doesn't seem like how you treat a hero.
Absolutely not. You know, and in fact, it's downright disrespectful to your point, right? My father served in Vietnam. I served in Desert Storm. My kids, one served in Afghanistan and Iraq. And you know, as a parent, it was painstaking to watch my daughter go over to Afghanistan and go to these different countries. But at the same time, like you said, we come back and we get all these, flowers and all that. Well, the real respect is taking care of us during these type of situations. All of the accolades that you can give us mean absolutely nothing if you don't pass legislation or you don't do what you're supposed to do right by veterans, seniors, people who have really, really put it in for this country. It's downright disrespectful, Rick.
No, I remember going back through all of those years while things were going on, because I grew up during the end of the Vietnam era. I came aware, and in the housing project I grew up in, I was a minority in a minority community. They dumped those men back into our community like garbage.
And it was awful.
There was nothing for them. And I said, if we're going to go down this path, if this is what we're going to do, we can't repeat the sins of the past. And I look at this, I look at a 22% cut. That just seems,
horrible.
I don't even have the word for it. Horrible is not enough.
No, it's not.
Cruel, mean, just angering. We're going to go with that. So I guess the last line of questioning I've got for you is, look, we've laid out how bad this can be for small business, how bad it's going to be for veterans. What do people do? Because there's always a sense of hopelessness. What's the empowerment moment out of this, Shondell?
Well, I think people need to make sure that they reach out to their legislators and talk to those folks and just flood them with talking about anything from cutting Social Security, cutting veterans benefits, to all the things that can possibly go wrong. Me and my business, Rick, you know what? I always tell my staff, you can only cut but so much. At some point, you got to raise revenue. At some point, you got to make sure that you take care of things from a business standpoint to keep it flowing. And like in this case, you know, most of these things have already been paid for. So all we got to do is just raise the debt ceiling. Like you said, the million times that we've done it before, it was no issue. And even coming out of our former President Trump's mouth one time, you can't negotiate with a debt ceiling. That is non-negotiable. And definitely a 22% cut or any type of cut to veteran services is downright non-negotiable. So I just think they have to just do what they have to do. And everybody should reach out to their legislators and just let them know how they feel.
You I know I said last question, but you hit something that caught my nerve. because you don't hear small businesses talk like this very often. You said you got to raise revenue.
Yes.
And you look at the fact that, you know, in polling, the vast majority of people in this country want the wealthy to pay higher taxes.
Absolutely.
I keep saying we need to dig up the good socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower, and return to that kind of a tax code. Are you advocating for higher taxes on businesses, on the wealthy? What are you going for?
So here's what I'll say. Here's what I always say. When it comes down to me as a small business owner, I'm paying my fair share of taxes. I think everybody should. I don't think anybody should get a break or get anything special just because they've acquired a certain level of wealth. And if it's going to lean anyway, it should actually lean towards the folks who actively engage in their local communities. I don't see anyone who got those tax breaks in my community helping to sponsor baseball teams, helping to take care of their churches, buying local goods and services in our neighborhood. I know, you know, I grew up in Brooklyn. And I remember the little corner stores and the dry cleaners and all of that. Those folks put back into the community. I don't see us going out and getting a new boat or a new house or a vacation home. What we do is we put everything right back into the community. So what I say is, yes, everybody should pay their fair share. Small businesses always pay our fair share, and we always take care of our communities at the same time. So I think every American, if you call yourself American, you should take care of your country.
I'm right there with you, Sean Dell. Real quick, some new marketing. What do you do?
You know, we do a lot of public engagement, public involvement, and that's another impact. We do a lot of that with the federal government. You know, they went around and said to small businesses, hey, you should go out and get federal contracts. You should go out and do this. You should go out and do that. So when they start playing with federal services, that impacts our business after they told us to go out and get these type of contracts. So that those are the games that have an impact on us, the Americans, America's small businesses, is that we participate in the manner that our country asked us to participate. And so when we play shenanigans and games, it doesn't impact the wealthiest people, right? They go on and do what they're still on vacation somewhere or on the moon or something. We don't get to do that. We don't get to hide. We don't get to hide from our employees, Rick. When these things happen, we don't get to go into an ivory tower and get away from everything. We're right in the thick of it. So, you know, some new marketing is proud to be 17 years strong, 2015 SBA Nevada Small Business of the Year. Last week, I won an award with SBA Nevada for the Entrepreneurial Spirit of the Year Award, but it's because I'm passionate about small businesses. And I think that we along with other groups, are very disrespected when these type of situations come up.
Well, I'm glad you took some time for us, filled us in on what you're doing. Good luck in D.C. Give them hell. Bring it to them, Sean Dell.
I definitely will, Rick. I promise that.
Thanks so much, Sean Dell Newsom. He is the co-chair of Small Business for America's Future, smallbusinessforamericasfuture.org, the website. Also, the co-founder of Some New Marketing. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com. Quick break.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1970. On that day, workers and the U.S. labor movement lost a leading voice in a tragic plane crash. There is no greater calling than to serve your fellow men. There is no greater contribution than to help the weak. There is no greater satisfaction than to do it well. These inspiring words were the credo of Walter P. Reuther, the longtime leader of the United Automobile Workers. Reuther became president of the UAW in 1946 and held that position for a quarter of a century. Under his leadership, auto workers saw some of the greatest gains. The UAW was able to win improvements in job security, health care, and wages. Reuther Luther's effective leadership caused the governor of Michigan to dub him the most dangerous man in Detroit. Luther learned about the labor movement from his father, a member of the Brewers Union in Wheeling, West Virginia. As a young man, Luther moved to Detroit to work in the booming auto industry, landing a job at Ford. He became involved in union organizing, gaining national prominence as he led a strike against General Motors in 1945. The next year, he was elected president of the UAW. Luther believed that unions were part of a broader social movement and had the power to improve the lives of all working Americans. He was a strong supporter of the civil rights movement, delivering a speech at the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. As UAW president, he placed an emphasis on worker education. In 1960, the UAW built an education center in northern Michigan. Walter and his wife May were flying there when their plane crashed, killing them both. President Nixon called Luther's death a deep loss not only for organized labor, but also for the cause of collective bargaining and the entire American process.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
So I got an interesting email last night. It's one of I always love religious people who feel they need to insult at every opportunity. You know, taking the high road. I believe in religion and God Incorporated and all that. And then, you know, throwing insults and barbs, which I enjoy. As I say, you know, email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Crazy, you know, angry, mean emails to the top. And this was one of those weird kind of moments and a lot of accusations, you know, like, evidently I'm centrist and left-leaning, which I guess is an insult. And I have a distaste for things religious, which is not true. I have a disdain for extremism. I have a disdain for zealotry. I have a disdain for people judging other folks who've never walked a mile in their shoes. I got some of those problems. I do. I tend to believe, as I always have said, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. You lead your best life. You lead the life that you want between you and your maker. I'm not the person to tell you what to do or not to do in the confines of your four walls. But there are some who do, and they tend to skew toward this hyper-religiosity, this kind of mean-spirited religion that I didn't grow up around. I grew up, you know, with the peace and social justice Jesus. I grew up with the Jesus who would walk picket lines and heal the sick and feed the hungry. That's where I grew up. This kind of angry Jesus I'm struggling with, because it's almost as if you have folks who use this as a crutch to be who they are, angry and mean and divisive. I grew up believing that the religion was supposed to bring you together. It was supposed to be part of of a community. It was supposed to make you a better person, or at least want to be a better person. You know, more humble, you know, less selfish. But I see in this modern era of the kind of religiosity that's being, you know, thrown out here. It's all about the, you know, everyone has their personal relationship and everyone's going to be wealthy and everyone's going to get what they deserve if they don't do exactly what they're told. I'm struggling with that. You know, I grew up believing that, you know, do unto others as you'd want them to do to you, or at least don't treat someone as any worse than you would want someone to treat you badly. You know, the golden or the silver rule, whichever makes you happy. But he goes through this list of, you know, it was all these religious people who did all these things. And there's a rewrite of history. You know, this idea that the country was founded by Christians is, I don't know, completely accurate. There were some, but a lot of the founding fathers were deists. So, you know, there's a lot of this. I'm claiming this portion of history for my team and my hat or my cape or whatever. Instead of using religion and faith for good, we're using it to tear each other apart. This kind of attack is, well, he goes after, you know, people who live in cities and, you know, all of the right-wing blather that you get. But doing it in a way that it's because of you godless heathens that all this is happening. And the reality is in those cities, there are lots of religious people. Bad things happen to people regardless of their faith. So I'm just, I hope it made him feel better, but it didn't make a lot of sense. But I'd love to hear your thoughts. Should we be pursuing the hooray for me and the heck with you, Jesus, or the hippie liberal? Let's take care of each other. Maybe not get people be homeless or hungry. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the pop.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic ABC Media app. News.